You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with us is my lovely co-host today, Shemaine Montana, who's also our producer.
Good afternoon.
It's a beautiful day, and Caroline couldn't be with us today, but Shemaine's going to... She's been filling in my shoes the last couple weeks, and now she gets to fill in for Caroline today. And we have a really interesting guest today. You want to tell the listeners a little bit about our guest?
Yes, our guest is Alan Gompers. He was born in 1939 in the Bronx and grew up in Parkchester, a middle-class housing project with a population of close to 60,000 people. That's some housing project.
That's like six times the size of Fairfield.
Affectionately known in the music industry as Pop Doo-Wop, for many years he produced concerts that brought together legendary original artists from the 1950s. After serving his time in a maximum security prison, Alan has traveled around the United States and Canada speaking to organizations and groups on the power and healing qualities of meditation. Welcome, Alan.
Who was that masked man that you just read about?
Somebody very intriguing.
Well, that's what we're going to find out today. So, Alan, as we start out, you're coming to Fairfield, right?
I'll be there between the 3rd and the 9th.
And what are you going to do while you're here?
Well, I'm going to be doing some book signings at 21st Century Books and at Revelations. I'm doing workshops, and they're going to keep me busy. I'm really looking forward to being there.
Tell us a little bit about how you came to be coming to Fairfield. Do you know someone here? Is there some connection? Do you have some connection with Fairfield?
Yeah. Well, actually, a very dear friend of mine, visits there quite often, and he made me aware of this incredible community that, I mention it to people everywhere I go. So many people are not aware even that it exists, and the fact that it's such a deep, rich community spiritually and culturally and every other way was kind of a revelation to me.
So you visited here before, have you?
No, this will be my first time.
Okay.
Well, we're definitely looking forward to having you here. And, of course, you're coming for Art Walk Weekend, which is a wonderful time to experience Fairfield.
We're looking forward to welcoming you.
So the title of Alan's book is Maximum Security, The True Meaning of Freedom. Alan, why did you decide to write this book?
Well, first of all, it was the writing of this book was, without trying to sound otherworldly here, was really an exercise of gratitude. My whole life, up until I had this spiritual awakening, was just a living nightmare. And after my life turned around in some of the most bizarre incidents I could ever imagine, it was like somebody turning on a light in a dark room. And I began to see the world in a way I never did before, as an experience, not as as a cliche, not as something people write about and talk about and speculate about. This was nothing like that at all. This was an incredibly deep and powerful experience, undeniable. And out of it came a sense of joy and happiness I had never even knew existed. And I felt so happy and so free that as I began to explore this initial experience, for the first time in my life, I started to feel grateful. And as I traveled around the country and started giving this story and speaking in front of groups and organizations all over the country, people would come up to me many times in tears, say to me, "You know, you really, really need to write a book." I would look at them like they were half crazy because I never wrote anything in my life. No idea where to even begin. But this went on for almost 15 years. And after a while, I got to a point where I started to say, well, maybe this is, these people are legitimately saying this and not just being praiseworthy or being nice because they had a nice experience when they heard me speak. But I began to realize it was genuine. And they, coupled with my gratitude for how I was experiencing my life now, I felt that I really needed to do this. I began.
A lot of spiritual seekers do meditation and other spiritual practices hoping to have the kind of experience of awakening that you had. And reading your book, it sounded to me like your experience just came from pure grace. Is that how you see it?
When framed in that way, absolutely. I've come to, you know, one of the things that's come out of this experience for me was the realization that as the spiritual life begins to unfold, I began to experience deeper and deeper awarenesses, insights into things, understandings into things. I just never knew before, and with it came these understanding of how this is all happening. That it didn't just happen in that moment of Shaktipat, that descent of grace, is what it really means. But it was a process from as many of the scriptures talk about, lifetime after lifetime of karmic, you know, getting rid of karmic baggage that we've been carrying. Actions from the past, things that follow us through until we wake up, till we awaken. And that moment of awakening for me started to unfold rich experiences into why this was all happening. And I understand now that that moment that this all happened was the culmination of a balancing of what my teacher always talk about, balancing your karma, where your actions from the past come to a kind of homeostasis, a balance. And in that moment, you are totally empty. And the experience of being in prison served to finally get me to let go, because I had nothing to hold on to.
Do you think that if you had not gone to prison, you would not have had this experience?
Well, that was my destiny for me to go to prison. But my sense of things now is, if it didn't happen that way, my ego was going to set me up for something equally as intense. Some people experience these things in a near-death experience, in a death of a loved one, whatever the situation was, an experience so powerful that it shorts out your mind, it shorts out your thinking process. So you, because I know and I understand now that all pain and suffering comes out of the mind, out of thought itself.
We had a guest on the show.
Yeah, it would have happened eventually some way. If it didn't happen through the prison experience, you know, maybe I would have, some other intense moment would have showed up to get me to let go.
One of our former guests, Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, had the experience from having a stroke.
Absolutely. Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
in the left hemisphere of her brain. Yeah, which was important. It would have been a different experience.
Yeah, that's true.
Otherwise.
Now, Alan, you call this experience Shaktipat. Are there other names for this in other traditions that people might understand?
There are lots of names for it, and you know, everybody's, you know, when people get to a place where they really are wide open, then definitions don't really play a part because they're all synonyms. For example, awakening, supreme consciousness, being born again, Shaktipat, Nirvana, whatever, truth, love, all of that is a way in which we experience the truth. We experience ourselves at the very deepest level. And that moment that it happens, you know, in retrospect, as I look back, I realize that in that moment, my mind, for the first time in my life, was totally still. There was nothing going on, zero. And what happened from within, you know, when the mind gets quiet, my teacher always used to say, what is left is God. What is left is the self. What is left is Shakti. What is left is the guru. What is left is wisdom and truth at the very, very deepest level. So the whole essence of meditation is to get to a place where the mind finally gets quiet, or we step outside of it, transcend it, get beyond it, whatever the words are. But it's no longer a distraction.
Now, you had this experience sitting in prison in the yard, completely unexpected, and from that you knew you wanted to begin immediately a daily meditation practice and keep that up. And how did you know that that's what you needed to do?
I'm not being cute now, and I'm not being arrogant. Have you ever fallen in love?
Sure.
Well, could you tell me how you resist that?
Ah, okay.
It's irresistible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you're in love, all you want to do is to be with the one you love.
Right, right.
All you want is that experience. All you want is more of it. I was in and out of love my whole life. My father always used to tell me, you're not in love. You're too young. You don't know anything about, you don't know what you're doing. You know, you're not in love. And, you know, the feelings were undeniable to me. But when I had that experience of meditation, I experienced love in a way that I never realized that it had nothing at all to do with anything or anyone. That it was completely free of needing anything or anyone. It was totally free.
Now, when you
so powerful.
So then when you started, like, intentionally meditating, did you get the same experience immediately that you had gotten from your unintentional meditation?
That's a really neat question. At that time in my life, we need to understand that when this happened, I had been sentenced to 15 years to life. I had a life bid, and I was sentenced to a maximum security prison. And all I knew in my mind, all I resonated with in my mind, was the word life. Mm. I had been lonely and afraid and depressed and insecure my whole life. On the outside, everybody thought I was this wizard, this successful, high-powered, amazing guy that always made things happen. And that was the perception. Inside, I was dying. And I had no way of knowing how to get out of these feelings, and everything I did was an attempt to try to find some way out of it. Ultimately, it led me to doing drugs and getting busted, and there I am with a life bid, 15 to life, and the only thing I could focus on is life, the word life, feeling I'd never get out of prison ever again. That was where I was at, more lonely and depressed and frightened than I'd ever been in my whole life. And I get out into the prison yard that day for the first time, and I wind up sitting down in front of a building, looking out over the wall, and spontaneously, without any idea what I was doing. My eyes closed, my legs crossed, and I went into meditation. Now, I had no idea what I was doing. I had never meditated before. I didn't even know what meditation meant or what it was. But when I opened my eyes again, those feelings that I had with me my whole life, plus all of the horror of the prison that I was in, the walls, the gun towers. My wife had wound up with another man after we had just renewed our vows prior to me being busted. She was the love of my life. That hurt worse than almost the sentence itself. My business collapsed. My children seemed like they were from 100 years away. And that I might not ever get out ever again. Ladies, I tell you that I was sitting on the ground looking out, feeling happier and more at peace that I never even knew existed. I didn't know where it came from. I certainly didn't know what to do, or I didn't do anything to make it happen. Nothing gave it to me. But the experience was undeniable. Can you picture this? Sitting there in a yard with 15 years to life, having never been in prison before, having your whole world taken away from you, loneliness and fear at a crescendo more than I thought I could bear in that moment, and then suddenly winding up in meditation, opening my eyes, feeling happier than I ever did my whole life.
Well, you had nothing left to lose. You know, maybe that was why
left to lose and jump off a building.
Maybe that's why you were open to that experience at that point, because you had nothing left to lose.
Well, yeah. Everything I had was taken from me. So there was the way I see it now is that in that moment, everything, and I think this is the most crucial understanding in the spiritual life. That's what this book is all about, is understanding that there is absolutely nothing at all in this world that has any power over you. And when I got back to my cell after that experience, I was in a cell block with 36 lifers. And one of the guys in the block walked up to me and handed me a book, and he said, "Hey man, check this out." And it was a picture of an Indian meditation master on the cover of the book. And when I sat down to read it, as I grabbed it in my hands, my knees buckled. And as I began to read the book, I had never read anything like this in my whole life. It wasn't so much the words, although they were powerful. It was, there was an energy that came through the words, a presence that brought me into that same experience out in the yard that I had again and again and again and again. And as I read it, one of the first things that I came across, and to answer your question, by the way, the more I meditated, the more I followed this practice, the deeper I got into meditation, the more my life unraveled in a way that was beyond my wildest dreams. In a state, I was walking around so happy, so free all the time, and unafraid. All the fear was taken away.
Wow.
And as the first thing that this Indian meditation master said, right after I came back from that experience, was that the world and everything in it has absolutely no power over you. You have to choose to be afraid. You have to choose to be insecure. You have to choose to be a failure.
And yet that seems to be the default choice for so many people.
That's what?
It seems to be the default choice for so many people. You know, that's what they choose.
In what sense do you mean?
Well, I agree with you that it's something that you have to choose, and yet some people, or it seems like most people, choose that without even being conscious that they're making that choice.
Well, you know, if you do it unconsciously and you're not connected to the deepest part of yourself, it's just a concept. It comes and it goes. You know, we have insights and we have revelations and things happen, and the next thought is, what's for dinner?
Yeah.
This was not like that at all.
No, I'm saying that that it seems like most people do choose to be afraid. They do choose to be insecure, but they don't realize that they're making a choice, that it's like by default.
Well, yeah, you're describing karma, And karma is always an unconscious action, and that's what he was saying. He was saying that when you are aware, you choose consciously, and if you're walking down the street and there's a banana peel, you see it, you're aware of it, you walk around it. If you're walking and you're in your head, and you're in a stream of thoughts, then you are not paying attention to what you're doing, and you create actions unconsciously that bring you karmic results that most people don't know where they came from. And as a result, they start blaming the world and things around them for it, when what he was saying was that when you become conscious, you become aware. And now you've made conscious choices, and as a result, you start to live dharmically without creating the pain and suffering that comes along with being in your head.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Alan Gompers, the author of Maximum Security, The True Meaning of Freedom. Alan, when was your book published?
It was published actually in May of 2008. Great day.
How did it change your life to get a first book published?
Well, you know, it was wonderful because I've been given so much support. I mean, Grace continues to shower me with people and support and praise and love. I mean, I have, and again, this is, you know, I don't want to sound promotional here, because that's we have yet, you know, myself, my staff, anybody connected to this project, we have yet to have anybody who's come back, critic, writer, reader, whatever, with anything but praise for the book. I haven't had a negative,
review?
Any negative impact anywhere. It's been a blessing, absolute blessing, to hear people tell me that they've had transformational experiences, that they use it. A psychiatrist telling me they're using it in their practice, people telling me it's changed their life, helped their children. It's beyond, you know, here I am, you know, looking in the mirror, you know, 30 years ago, and I'm looking at a drug dealer. Mm-hmm. And now I'm looking out at the world, and people are looking at me as if I'm you know, some kind of, you know, good guy. And I'm happy for that perception. Better than
sure.
The old one, you know.
I'm sure. Well, tell us a little bit how you, you said you'd never written anything. And the writing, you know, the writing in this book is actually very, it's very conversational. It's very direct and intimate and easy to read. It has a nice flow. So how did you, as a non-writer, accomplish that?
Well, one of the first things I came to learn when I began to write, and it came out of my meditation, and it came verified by other great people out in the universe. One of them was Neil Donald Walsh, who wrote Conversations with God. Mm. And he had his friend of his, if you've read any of his books, Ed Asner, the actor who counseled Donald Walsh when he was writing the book, and because he was afraid that, you know, writing such a controversial kind of conversation, him and God, he found it to be very, very, almost frightening about the way the world was going to view what he was saying, that he was, you know, having a conversation with God. And of course, that's not where it was coming from. And but Ed Asner told him, he said, listen, if you write this book and you're not totally transparent and you don't put everything out exactly the way you have experienced it, the way you know it to be true, without thinking about what may come back, what criticism you may get, and trying to play to the audience, so to speak, trying to make it palatable for other people, it will be disingenuous, and that will bring you back all your problems.
Mm.
He said, the power in this book is in your integrity of your own inner experience. Do not at any level compromise that.
Don't try and make yourself look
that.
Good.
What's that?
Don't try and make yourself look good.
That's right.
Yeah.
I noticed that too. I felt in reading your book that you were describing experiences that can't be faked. Someone who hadn't had the experiences you've had couldn't make it up, because your description had so much detail and life in it. It was really beautiful to read.
And you didn't...
Why, thank you so much.
And you weren't making yourself look good in the first part of the book. You were being very honest about your flaws and the mistakes that you made. But I think that was an important...
That's the transparency that I was talking about.
Right.
And, you know, one of the editors that I had in the very beginning, and I wound up, this book took me about 10 years to write. Because every time I thought I was done, somebody else would look at it and say, Alan, check this out, blah, blah, blah. And then I would have to go, I rewrote this book I don't know how many times. And because, I mean, one of the first times an editor checked this out, what she said to me, she said, Alan, she said, the book reads in your voice continuously. It's beautiful. She said, but I have one place here where you're describing yourself and your use of drugs and selling drugs and everything, she said, and there was an energy coming out of there that was almost trying to make yourself saying, well, I was a drug dealer, but I wasn't selling to, you know, the street. I was selling to friends, and I wasn't really a bad guy kind of a thing. You know, I really was a good guy doing bad things. And she said, hey, you can't do that. And you are a drug dealer. When she said it, it like pierced my heart. I said, it was like, I knew I was a drug dealer, but this is the first time I had to face it head on, 100% with no frills attached. I had to really own it. And the minute I did, I became freer in my writing than I ever did before, because now I could be totally transparent. I knew I had to face every hidden demon. I had to put it all out there. I had to hide nothing, and I had to put it out in my own voice. That was the first and most important lesson I got as a writer.
So how did you know when the book was finished after all those drafts? How did you know now is the time? It's done.
Again, you know, it's an inner experience. You know, we all have these things, you know, like relationships. We go through them no matter how many times we try to keep them together. We want them so bad to work out. How much we want our business to do this, that, or the other thing. There comes a point where there is no more possibility. You got to let it go. There's no way. Or it gets. That's how I got 15 to life. I was the greatest manipulator in the world, or I'm pretty good at it. But I got myself into a place where I couldn't do it anymore, and I got busted with an intensity that made me finally let go. I couldn't control it anymore. My ego lost its power, because the power of grace is far stronger than any outer power or any ego or mind can ever do. Eventually, you got to let go. And you just know at some point, if you do it voluntarily, you save yourself some pain and suffering. If you hold on to the very end like a pit bull, it gets busted anyway. And then you know after the fact, in retrospect, I'm so glad I'm out of that situation. There's a sigh. You know, when I got busted, finally, and this all happened, I felt lighter and freer than I ever did in my whole life, because I had let go of holding on to all the pain and suffering. So you know. We always know.
So you knew when the book was finished.
What's that?
So you knew when the book was finished, when it was ready to be published. It was something you just knew.
Yeah, and we my final editor knew, my marketing director knew, my agent knew, and, you know, finally, you know, I wanted it to end a lot of times before it did, and so finally I just surrendered to it and said, I'm enjoying this process. Why am I trying to end it? It'll end when it's ready to end. And I trusted that.
Well, how did you stay...
As time went on.
How did you stay motivated over 10 years of working on this? You know, what kept you going on it?
In writing it was, it deepened me in my meditation practice. It changed my relationships to people. And most of all, it gave me a deeper understanding of myself, because I had to go through everything I ever did in my life. I had to face it. And, you know, my teacher always used to say, the only way to freedom is to face your deepest fears. There's no other way to freedom than to meet your fears and stand firm in them and walk through to the other side. So So if we keep avoiding it, if we keep denying them, suppressing them, hiding, running away from them, they will haunt us, like she used to talk about, like running away from your hair when it's on fire.
Can't be done.
Can't be done. But when you stop and you look at it, you now have choices as to what to do. You can put it out. You can put water over your head. You know, I'm blowing it up to make it look more real. But eventually, you know, when you stop and face your fears, it's like, you know what it's like? Hollywood made its fortune in horror films on just that premise. If you ever notice in a horror film, the first half of the film is scary music, scenes where a dead cat falls out of the closet when you thought the monster was going to jump out, kinds of things that make you afraid, right?
Right.
And then finally, at one point when you've gone through all of these fears and setups that are not real, without your expectation happening, a door opens and suddenly there's the monster, you never expected it, and you go into a state of shock. And you scream. And it's in that moment, they know, after that, if you think about it, that monster, no matter how ugly he is, no matter how much mucus and saliva is coming out of his face and how many scars he has, he can never quite scare you the same way ever again.
That's true.
Yeah, and it's facing fear is exactly the same way. Once you face it, it begins to lose its power.
Well, speaking of fear, did you have any fear that members of your family would not react positively to your book?
All except one time, and it was a very, very tough moment in my life. Because up until after the book was even released, and a year later, the book is out now. And my family loved it. Everybody loved it. My kids, my brother, my sister-in-law. I mean, everywhere I went intimately within my own family, they all loved the book. And they all enjoyed it so much. And my daughter calls me up one day, my youngest one. I have four kids. And she said, Dad, you know, and I was divorced from her mom for like, 12 years. She was remarried again and all of that. And she says, Dad, she said, Mom is freaking out. I said, why? She said, because you wrote in the book about her being with another man, and you wrote things about her in the book, and she's got a new life, and she's married again, and she's past all of that, and she doesn't want that, all of that stuff to come out again, and on and on and on. And I said to her, everything I wrote in that book for your mother, and we were very, very close and great friends, even after the divorce, was about my love for her and how much I loved her. And I never said that or anything in the book to paint her in any other light. This was just my own experience that I was talking about. It was my life, my experience of how I felt when all of this happened. And she said, well, you better not put that book out.
Uh-oh.
All of that out of the book. I said, honey, it's already published. And there was this moment in time in my life where my heart just hurt so bad, because the last thing in the world I would ever want to do is to hurt that woman, because I love her. I still love her. The romantic part is out, but as a being, as a sensitive, beautiful being, she's the love of my life. And I always felt that she felt the same way. And here it was being just destroyed. And I had to make a decision. Well, I'm going to pull the book off the shelves? Am I going to stop? Am I going to republish it? What am I going to do? And in that moment, I had to really go deep into contemplation and really see what the Shakti wanted me to do here. And what came up for me was, I love her. There was nothing else but love coming from me when I wrote about her and what I think about her, and there was no reason in my mind to feel that I did anything that would in any way dishonor that sense of heart that I felt for her. And so I let it go. And over time, And thank God it has played itself out. It was the right thing to do.
That's good. That's always a tricky thing with memoir, you know, because you took the advice that I think is very good advice of being totally honest and transparent and not trying to hide anything about yourself in telling your story, but you can't do that without telling other people's stories too, and mm-hmm. they may not be so thrilled about that honesty and transparency. So,
you know, I must have rewritten that those sections that she objected to a zillion times until I got it where I knew that I was coming from my heart and my experience. And I know that when I'm putting things out from that place, and there's a real deep discrimination that goes with it. It's like people can say, well, how do you know that? You know, how do you know you're telling the truth? How do you know this? How do you know that? It's that same knowing when you fall in love, you know you're in love. And I trusted that. I had to trust that. I trusted it in every phase of the book. And, you know, when I got to places where I was stuck, the writing would stop, it was because I was up in my head.
Mm.
And that shocked me. That grace would not allow me to continue writing. Sometimes I would sit there with a sentence for days. I couldn't go forward until I got very clear and very transparent about this was the absolute essence of my truth. Before, and once that happened, suddenly, spontaneously, like without even thinking, the words just poured out of me.
Did you have a specific writing routine that you used while you were working on this project? Like, did you write every day at a certain time, or was there anything specific that you did to keep writing?
Well, when I was out in California first, and I started doing this whenever I got time. It was like 3-4 hours a day that I would just get to it, but the writing was so spontaneous and so prolific without... I would sit down and it was just like 3 or 4 hours would just go by in a flash. And I'd get up and I was high. I was just flying. And when I got back to New York, though, I was going sometimes 8-10 hours a day. Sometimes I had to stop to make myself eat something.
Wow.
It was coming out so powerfully, and I was so riveted to what was going on that I couldn't wait to finish so I could read back what came out, because I was so in the moment with it, I wasn't even aware what I was writing. It would, you know, the athletes call it the zone, you know, where you can see the court, and you can't miss a shot, you know, everything happens perfectly. It was like that, but only it was far deeper than that. And it was reaching me at levels that was so joyful. And I loved every moment of it. I couldn't get enough.
Well, does that... So...
And the routine was, I would sit down, I would do some opening mantras around my meditation practice to get present, and then suddenly I was writing, and that was all. That was it.
So if you enjoyed the writing so much after this book was finished, are you working on any other writing projects?
I literally write all the time now. I've written a couple other books that are going to be coming down the pike. I've been writing contemplations on our newsletter that goes out to people all over the country and Canada. Everything I do, you know, I find writing now such a way of expression, such a way of being genuine, of being transparent, of being compassionate, of being loving and giving. That to me is the most important thing in my life now, is it to be in a state of giving, which is the state of love, all the time. Constantly. And I know that by giving, constantly giving, I know I'm not asking for anything back. I'm doing it for the love of doing it. Performing on stage because I love to perform. And if other people like it, great. And if they don't, you know. But I find that when I'm doing what I love, I'm putting out love. And it draws the universe to me. It draws people to me. It draws success to me. Most of all, it has brightened and shined and made life so rich and beautiful because I'm living, you know, I come to understand that when I'm offering from my heart, whether somebody else acknowledges it or not, it has to come through me first. I have to experience it. It has to come through me. more I'm giving. Giving and receiving is not getting from the outside, it's getting from the inside.
Mm.
I know now that I can't get anything from the outside. That's the outside is just a mirror. I get by giving.
Well, Alan, would you like to read something? Would you like to read a section from Maximum Security to our listeners today?
Sure. Sure.
This is Alan Gompers reading from Maximum Security, The True Meaning of Freedom.
Well, the part that I'd like to share with you, know, there's so many parts that I'd like to share, but this one was just such an amazing experience, and it was a revelation to me in terms of my life and the way we cause pain and suffering for ourselves and other people, and how to get out of that whole business through the power of meditation. And after I was in prison, I wound up getting work release, which is a premature, you know, I got executive clemency from the governor, a pardon at one point. And they reduced my sentence from 15 to life to 6 to life, and then I was granted work release after 5 years, which for a lifer, by the way, is unheard of. The people who usually get work release are the people who need it least. And lifers never get it because they're considered, you know, major crime and danger to society, so that's almost a no-no, but I got it. So I go down to this work release facility in the Bronx, and I go before my counselor, and they check me out, and they send me with a pass to go out for the first time now. It's 5.5 years later. I have never been out on the street, and I had to tell them that I was going out and going to try to find some kind of a job to maintain myself if I was released from the parole board. And this is the story of that day for the first time when I go down to the work release basement where you have to sign out and get your pass and walk through the door. And that day I walk downstairs and there's a line, I mean, it looked like the entrance to the World Series. You know, it was like it took me a half an hour before I got to the front to be able to get out. And here's what happened. Right from the book, a long line of inmates was already waiting when I arrived at the work release center at 8 o'clock a.m. that morning. At the front of the line, two correction officers sat behind a big desk. I took my place at the end of the line and soon found myself becoming agitated. I was anxious to get out into the world again. It seemed this would take some time and I wanted the line to move more quickly. It's a normal reaction, I said to myself. I was just not comfortable. So I closed my eyes, took deep breaths, and allowed myself to slow down. As my whole being relaxed and became clear, I asked myself, what's the message for me in this situation? What do I need to learn? The answer came instantly. Patience. Let the game come to you. A voice deep inside reminded me. You are an eternal being. What's the rush? Where are you going? Enjoy the play. With that insight, the edginess and tension began to dissolve, and I was able in that moment to let go. Right in front of me, in line, was a young Spanish kid in his mid-20s. Was animated and excited. He lived in my dorm, and we had never spoken before, but we acknowledged each other. He told me he'd been down in prison for 8 years and hadn't seen the street since he was 17 years old. His whole family was waiting for him outside the facility, including his girlfriend, whom he was planning to marry as soon as he was paroled. He kept saying how happy he was and how much he had to look forward to. He was through messing around with drugs and hanging out in the streets. God had given him a second chance and he was going to run with it and do the right thing. His mood was infectious. It took us almost a half an hour to get to the head of the line. When his turn came, the young man shook my hand, turned to me and said, "Well, wish me luck. Here I go." His face broke out wreathed in an enormous smile. As I let go of his hand, he turned quickly to face the desk and the guard behind it. "Wipe that smile off your face, you punk," fill in the blank, "and pay attention to what I'm going to tell you," the guard bellowed out at him. In an instant, the beautiful, engaging smile on the young man's face turned into an ugly scowl. The transformation was so dramatic, it seemed as if a different person had taken his place. For a split second, I thought he would leap over the desk and go for the guard's throat, but instead, he began a barrage of expletives that brought the room to total silence. The guard pointed his finger in the kid's face and warned him that he was treading on dangerous ground. But the kid was out of control, and each time the guard warned him to calm down, he became more furious and irrational. Within seconds, a half dozen correction officers appeared and grabbed him from behind. But nothing could stop him. He continued to scream obscenities at the guard behind the desk. He fought like a wild animal. I could see the veins in his neck distending as if they were ready to explode. Then the guards had him in handcuffs, and in a flash, he was gone. I stood there, staring at the door he just passed through. In one surreal moment, this young man had destroyed his life and his dreams. A few minutes before, he was happy, excited, and filled with possibility. In the blink of an eye, it was all gone. I was trying to gather a perspective on what I had just witnessed when I heard the same officer shouting obscenities again. This time, he directed the tirade at me. I had my back to his desk and was apparently holding up the line. I quickly turned to face him. I did not react to anything he said. I stood silently before him, waiting for him to finish yelling at me. He carried on for a while longer and then stopped and glared at me through narrowed eyes, daring me to say anything. He was taunting me as he had the young Spanish boy. But I was not walking into that trap. All my years of meditation and all of Muktananda's teachings in that moment were there fully to guide and support me. This was the moment of yoga. This was where the practices became practical, where theory became reality. I could allow this prison guard to break me down and cause me to lose my contentment and power. Or I could stay grounded and focused in my heart, no matter what he did. I understood that he could lock me up or let me go on my way. He had that choice and the power to back it up. But I had a choice too. And I had power. I could choose to accept whatever happened. And I had the power to do that without losing my contentment and my inner freedom. This was the ultimate choice, and it was the only one that mattered to me in that moment. As I reminded myself of this great teaching, every part of me came alive, and I gained strength. It didn't matter what he did to me any longer. I didn't need anything from him or from the world. What I wanted was to stay connected to who I was, not to lose it, and to maintain complete faith and trust in my own true self. I knew that if I could do that, grace would execute the next step in my life perfectly. The guard, with a look of disgust, turned the huge logbook around. "Sign your effing name and get the hell out of here," he snarled. I took the pen, signed my name, said thank you, and walked out the front door. It was as simple as that. I felt that I'd walked through the darkness of hell and into the light. Grace had never left me, even for a second. I stepped out the door and immediately encountered the Spanish kid's family. There they were, all gathered on the sidewalk, just as he said they would be, anxiously awaiting for him to walk through the door and into their arms. My heart nearly broke, as it ached for all of them, especially for my young friend, knowing that this beautiful reunion would never happen. Months later, I heard the price that that young man had paid. He was locked up that same day and shipped back upstate a week later. His work release was revoked. At the parole hearing, the parole board gave him 2 more years in prison. A few years before, that could have been me. I might have blown my chance too. Thanks to the Shakti, thanks to that awareness, thanks to being present, under the same set of circumstances, I had made it back to the world, free again, after 6 long years, my destiny unfolding with each step. Once again, my body was free, but more important, I was free. I was living the true meaning of freedom.
That was Alan Gompers reading from Maximum Security, The True Meaning of Freedom.
Thank you. That was wonderful. I'm glad you picked that selection. It was my favorite, and I've actually read that selection to a couple of friends to motivate them to read the book. Mm-hmm. So thank you. So now, so once you got out, after a little while, you had a career in doo-wop music, and then after that, you followed your heart and have begun teaching meditation in prisons. Is that correct?
In prisons and anywhere else where they will allow this little guy to show up.
Okay. And you're still involved in that.
The doo-wop thing, you know, I was a kid. We had a group, and it started back in the 50s, and the music was always it was the first experience of my heart before I ever even had a girlfriend. That music, you know, was so evocative. It opened up my heart in a way that the only way I could describe it is I felt like I fell in love. I couldn't get enough. And the music inspired me to want to find something tangible besides the music, and that's what led me to every phase of my life. You know, following my heart was something, even with all of the unhappiness and pain, there was a part of me that always supported my heart to find a way to get connected to it so I could get rid of the pain. But later on, I came back to the music when I got out, and it became a source of helping me to have the resources to be able to travel and teach meditation, because that's who I am. That's what my life's about now.
That's wonderful. Well, we just have a couple minutes left. Can you tell us, is there a prison meditation project that other people can get involved with?
Well, the prison project that I'm connected to is the SYDA Foundation. They can go to the website, and you know, I'm one of the coordinators for the program, and you know, I travel all over the country to various prisons doing it. And by the way, it's absolutely so wonderful. These men and women, you know, who are meditating in prison, you know, they find a way to get beyond the fear and the pain and the loneliness that comes along with long terms and stuff like that. And meditation takes them to a place where they're able to make really not only good use of their time in terms of rehabilitation, but it transforms their entire life. And to see it happen is extraordinary. The SYDA Foundation is the sponsor for this, SYDAFoundation.org. And if you go there and just go to the prison project, or they can go to my website, and contact me, and I'll be glad to help anybody who's interested directly, or my foundation will also.
Alan, one of the most interesting parts of your book to me was when you found out that you had received the governor's pardon, or executive clemency, and you didn't know at first if that would mean that you were being released immediately or when, and it turned out that it was, you know, that you had a couple more years after that to spend in prison. And you actually were relieved about that at that point, that you weren't ready to get out because you felt that the time that you were spending in prison was valuable time. And I found that really interesting. I have a friend who's in prison, and I see how much he may never get out, but he's not. it's easy for people out here to think that anyone in prison is wasting their life, but that's not necessarily true. I see that in this young man, the good that he does where he is, that he might never have done if he were on the street.
And the state, when we're really in our heart, it does. It ultimately, you know, Mike, when you're describing, a lot of people ask me about that. I was referring to the prison setting. That's where this all happened. And for me at that time, it represented, you know, I was teaching meditation in the prison. I had a meditation group. The ashram nearby was only 30 miles away. And they used to come in, and some of the spiritual teachers used to come in, and my mentor, who I met in prison, began to come in. I reference him in the book, Father Tom. He was a Catholic priest. And who had left the priesthood and found the fact that he was a true priest once he experienced meditation for the first time in his life, and all of these blessings coming to me, and the time, without having to work, without having to take any kind of formal responsibility. It wasn't that I was avoiding it, because I felt fine about going out into the world. I knew I could now make it better than I ever did before without manipulating anybody, but it was a gift. I mean, how many of us in this life, you know, we hear people say it all the time, to take some time for ourselves, to smell the roses, to be able to enjoy our life, to hug a tree, to give some roses to somebody that we love, to read a book, to reflect on our lives, to get freer than we've ever been. When we're so busy in the world that, we don't have time to even take care of ourselves. And here I was being given, three and a half more years. I could have been in the Army. I could have been a million different places against my will, but I no longer cared about that.
Well, Alan, thank you so much, because we're out of time today.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. No problem. But we really enjoyed having you with us, and you're coming back to Fairfield in June. You're going to be at 21st Century Bookstore June 5th, 7:30 to 9:30, and at Revelations Bookstore and Cafe Saturday, June 6th, 2 to 4 p.m., and then you're doing a workshop Sunday, June 7th, and people can check the Fairfield Weekly Reader for details on that. And we look forward to speaking with you again. And now, as we're wrapping up, I want to make sure that people stay tuned for Planet Erstwhile coming up from 2 to 5 with James Moore. In the first hour, he's got State Senator Becky Schmitz and State Representative John Whitaker talking about their legislative work. At 3 p.m., Jack Canfield, Dr. John Gray, Marcy Shimoff, and Janet Atwood, four leading transformational speakers and authors, will be talking with him, with James, in praise of the upcoming Fairfield visit of humanitarian Lynn Twist, author of The Soul of Money and president of the Panchamama Alliance, who's being honored with the mayor's first humanitarian award next month. And then at 4 p.m., he's talking with Campbell Hare, an original member of Wavy Gravy's Hog Farm, about his experiences setting up and running sound for the legendary Woodstock Festival. So that's what we've got coming up this afternoon. And for now, let's close with a quote.
This is a great one from Gandhi. Be the change you wish to see in the world. And thank you for joining us on Writers' Voices. Thank you so much, Alan.
Thank you, ladies. You were great. It was great to be here.
See you next week on Writers' Voices.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.